This is Judaism Unbound, episode 33, Jew Asian. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
And we're here today in the first episode of a four-episode arc where we continue to look at some of the issues and changes that are happening in the Jewish world today that really may have the biggest impact on the Judaism of the present and the future. Today, we're starting an arc which we're calling What Jewish Looks Like Today, where we're talking to and about folks who may not look like the kinds of people who Judaism thought of as Jews looking like when it evolved over the centuries. These are folks who are playing increasingly important roles in the Jewish world today, and we think will play an even greater role in the Jewish community of the future. So today we're starting off with our guests, Helen Kim and Noah Levitt. They are the authors of a book called Jew Asian, which came out not very long ago from the University of Nebraska Press, looking specifically at the questions of Jewish-Asian relationships. The way that Judaism manifests in such households, whether for the people in the relationship or for their children. Helen is Associate Professor of Sociology at Whitman College, and Noah is the Associate Dean of Students at Whitman College. They met as a PhD student back in the day, and their collaboration has gone forward in many very productive ways over time, which we'll talk about in the show. So, Helen, Noah, thank you so much for being with us today, and welcome to Judaism Unbound.
Thanks.
We are too.
So I thought we could just get started by asking you to give us a little bit of a summary for lay people of your book and why you undertook the project and what you think you've discovered.
Our book is a qualitative study that focuses on one particular example of what is commonly referred to as intermarriage. And by intermarriage, we're interested in mixed marriages and families across racial, ethnic, and religious lines. So we talked to couples where one partner is Jewish American of any racial or ethnic background, and the other partner is racially Asian of any religious or ethnic background. And we were interested to understand how it is that when two people fall in love and on paper they look demographically different, how it is that those differences come into play in terms of not only their love for each other, but how it is that they think about sustaining a marriage, and in particular for families that have children, how it is that these differences come into play when they think about raising kids. So that was the starting point of the book. We also interviewed adult millennial children who are the offspring of these kinds of relationships, to see how it is that adult millennials who are, again, on paper, a mix of a lot of different backgrounds, think about their respective identities, given that there's sort of this mixture of racial backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, and in some cases, religious backgrounds. So that's sort of the overview of the book. And we were really interested in trying to put a different spin on the discussion, particularly within the American Jewish community, about intermarriage and families that are intermarried.
In terms of the couples, we saw households doing several things that really got our attention. First, we saw, even with all of the different potential traditions, backgrounds, cultural streams coming through the two people, we saw what was a really muscular, energized, vibrant Judaism in the household that the couples were creating, and doing so in ways that, as we asked them the kinds of practices and the kinds of meaning-making experiences that they were including in their partnership and in their relationship, to us seemed very traditionally, classically, religiously Jewish. And that really caught our attention, because I think there had been an inclination as we were going into the project that there was going to be much more variation, possible dilution, combining traditions into these fusion practices, but almost none of that at all. And so that was one of our findings, that just really made us very excited about going further with this. Another finding with the couples was that one of the pieces of the internal domestic machinery that we saw in action was a conversation about a understanding of certain values that to the couples or the partners seem very similar from their respective backgrounds. And these are some of the, I think, points of often pride for in the Jewish community, the incredible attention to education, work ethic, respect of elders, involvement in communities. What we saw was those similar values coming through both of the members of the couples, even though they were coming from different directions. And what we saw was a conversation among the two people about how their relationship was able to be developed and enhanced and deepened by talking about the things that they both saw one another bringing into their household that may look from the surface different, but the couple saw them as being very similar. So in terms of the kids, a few things really came through that also made us excited and delighted and very curious. And I just want to point out that when we interviewed the young people, they were from households that had a Jewish and an Asian combination, but they were not children of the couples that we interviewed for the first part of the research. And so that was just a nice methodological step in that it allowed us to hear from young people what their upbringing was like in households that were like the ones we were curious about, but not directly from the kids of the couples we talked with. Anyway, they talked to us about how they saw themselves first as multiracial young people, as not white, not black, not Asian, but multi or interracial. And at the same time, they also talked about incredible Jewish practice, creativity, knowledge, Jewish learning, participation in myriad Jewish activities growing up in the kinds of households that we heard about from the couples earlier on. And so that was nice to hear what the couples had been saying they were trying to create validated by young people from those kinds of households. It was a nice, in some ways, a reliability check. So those are some of the, those are some of the key findings in terms of the kids. And I guess the last overall observation that we'd want to start our discussion with this afternoon would be about how the racial element of the households, either in the couple or in the multiraciality of the young people we met, often caused a bit of a jarring moment sometimes when they were interacting with members of the Jewish community who they described as having trouble seeing them as fully participatory, authentic, involved young people in congregations or in Jewish centers. And both the couples, but primarily the young people, talked about how they really found ways to respectfully resist and challenge and educate when those moments of troublesome questioning came up. They got annoyed, but they went past that and tried to use that Jewish learning opportunity to help whoever their questioner, their interlocutor was, see them as fully participatory in the Jewish community in their city or their neighborhood, wherever it may be.
Yeah, I want to come back to what you just spoke about in terms of the kinds of responses that the adult children of these relationships received from various Jewish communities. But I'm curious, before we go down that path, I'm curious what led the two of you to write this book and how it came to be. I know you mentioned in the book it was a years-long journey of many sorts, and I'm curious if you could walk us through how you got to this place where you're publishing a book on Jewish-Asian relationships.
Yeah, I mean, we came across the idea for the research kind of unexpectedly, but as something that's very familiar to us, given that we fit the demographic of these kinds of couples. And back in 2007, when we were thinking about having children and I became pregnant, and we kind of looked at each other one day and said, well, how exactly are we going to do this? And by this, what we were talking about was the meshing together of all of our kind of respective backgrounds, whether they would be racial, ethnic, or religious. So as good social scientists, we wanted to see on a larger demographic scale, what kinds of data was out there with regards not just to intermarriage along Jewish and non-Jewish lines, but whether or not there was any data that looked at that facet of intermarriage, specifically within the American Jewish community, but also to see whether or not there was data that looked at racial or ethnic differences. So in 2008, we kind of went to a lot of different big repositories of Jewish demography, and we asked, do you keep data on intermarriage, but intermarriage not just along religious lines, but also along racial lines? And everywhere we went, from Brandeis, the Cohen Center, to the University of Connecticut, to the Federations, even to the URJ, they indicated that they did not keep data on interracial marriages within the American Jewish community. But everybody at that time said, you should go and talk to Gary Tobin. And Gary Tobin had headed the Cohen Center at Brandeis, and he left academia to go start his own think tank. And one of the arms of the think tank, which is called the Institute for Jewish and Community Research, one of the arms of this institute was called B'chol Lashon. And he and his wife, Diane Tobin, set up this arm of IJCR specifically to explore the racial and ethnic diversity of Jews, not only in the United States, but across the world. So we struck up some conversations with them, and they had written a book that looked at the racial and ethnic diversity of the Jewish people within the United States. And they were really the only kind of source of data at the time on racial diversity. So they were very encouraging of us, and they helped us launch a recruitment survey, which we sent across the country to Jewish communal organizations, to rabbinical associations, interfaith networks, multiracial networks. And that is how we started to get the participants who ended up being the participants for the interviews that we did with couples. So back to your original question, it was really a question that we wanted to answer predominantly from a personal perspective, which became kind of a larger research project because we were interested in understanding not just the occurrence of these kinds of marriages and families, but how it is that couples and families were thinking about and kind of dealing with differences in their everyday life.
So looking at that issue that came up a little bit before that, I'm just itching to dive into. What were some of the interesting anecdotes that you found with respect to the children of intermarriage that you interviewed and how they related to Jewish communities? And what are some of either the lessons or knowledge that you took from those? Or maybe even, you know, what are some ideas that you would propose for individuals that are involved with those organizations to try and do better with respect to those populations of Jews who we might say, quote, don't look Jewish, knowing how problematic that phrase even is, but for whom we still might be relating in a different way than we would, you know, a white Jewish person that walks through the door.
So I'll just start by reflecting on a conversation that we had recently with a rabbi at a synagogue in the United States who was talking to us about the rabbi's interest in perhaps opening up some discussion in her congregation about how her members can be as inclusive as possible in responding to all the different kinds of households that either were participating in their congregation or potentially could participate in their congregation that lived in the community. And I was really struck by the two ways that this rabbi was talking about the possible ways to go with that. One was to just talk about inclusion incredibly broadly. You know, we want to have everyone who has any interest in Judaism be able to come in here and worship and celebrate and meet people, create community, find some inner insight or peace or wisdom through our Jewish practice. That was one. And then the other one was we really should be opening up conversations about race and being mindful of households that are multiracial in our congregation or in the community that might become connected to our congregation. And it really made me think about how challenging it is across large parts of the American Jewish community, how challenging it is to talk about race. To your question, some of what we heard from the young people we interviewed was that for them, they see the world through a very racialized lens because they are themselves presenting to the world in a racialized way that they're very attentive to and that they get a lot of feedback from. And so as we think about the ways that congregations and the Jewish organizations and kind of organized Jewish community in the United States can be, I think, attentive to the next generation that is going to, as Helen was saying earlier, be more and more mixed in more and more ways. Having the ability inside congregations to have race be a part of the conversation in a way that is not only presenting itself at moments of crisis or moments of police shootings or moments of Black Lives Matter news, but that's just part of the way the congregation thinks about all of its members and learns about all of its members and celebrates all of its members. The young people we met were really saying that since so much of what their life is about is being racialized, that when that is not able to be included in the way that a Jewish community interacts with them, they're not going to stick around for very long.
To piggyback off that, you know, we often heard adult millennial kids say that because of what it is that they looked like, or maybe the combination of what it is that they look like in terms of being racially ambiguous or presenting more as Asian in combination with their names, there was something that signaled to Jews and non-Jews that they were not, quote, authentically Jewish. So they often heard comments like, oh, that's funny, you know, you don't look Jewish, or, oh, wait a second, you know, that means that you're half Jewish, you're actually not fully Jewish. And a number of the participants indicated when that they were confronted with those kinds of challenges to who it is that they were, rather than downplaying their Jewish identity and their Judaism, their response was that they actually felt like they had to be more Jewish in order to kind of prove their authenticity. And in some ways, that's a bummer. But in other ways, I think one interpretation is that they were saying to us that in those moments, they were making the choice to present themselves as Jewish, to enact their Judaism, rather than to shy away from it and to reject it. The puzzle with regards to how it is that Jewish communal organizations and the Jewish community can respond, that's a great moment that the Jewish community can kind of take advantage of, because this is a population that wants to be Jewish, even in light of these kinds of really frustrating and demeaning challenges to who it is that they are. I'm always reminded of Angela Buchdahl, Rabbi Angela Buchdahl Warnock's story that she often talks about having these kinds of same comments put in front of her multiple times, and her going to her mother and saying, you know, I don't want to be Jewish anymore. I think decades later, you have a different population of adult millennial children who want to take that challenge and want to continue to be Jewish.
And I'm curious why you think that is.
I think it's a number of things. I think part of it is the larger cultural context, social context in which millennials exist. So millennials think about the world as, I can choose to be 1,000 different things all at the same time. And I can choose to be Asian and Korean and Jewish and possibly Buddhist. And I don't want to necessarily preference one over the other. I want to be all of those things at the same time. And given the fact that they were raised with a really strong Jewish identity, often in religious ways, to turn around and then reject that aspect of who it is that they have always been, I think would be not affirming who it is they are and all of the choices that they believe are in front of them. So there's a real kind of grasping on to multiple identities, religious, spiritual, racial, ethnic, as opposed to seeing them as competing and needing to reject one here and another there.
So you mentioned Angela Buchdahl, both. I never know whether to say Rabbi Angela Buchdahl or Cantor Angela Buchdahl or both, because she's both. But you just brought her up. And just for those who might not be familiar, she is a very prominent Reform rabbi who is would fall into this category that we've discussed of the children, the adult children of Asian Jewish marriages. And she's spoken publicly about this and is really an inspiring figure. And actually, you framed your book by mentioning her and a ceremony that she led, the Hanukkah candlelighting at the White House. I was actually there, funny enough. And I was standing near a past guest of ours, Paul Golan, who himself is part of a partnership that would fall under Jew-Asian. And I remember being in that room and just thinking, oh my gosh, this is a beautiful, beautiful moment. And Angela Buchdahl even spoke, and you quote her in your book, as saying, you know, I don't think that the founding fathers had in mind that an African-American president would be lighting a menorah with an Asian-American female Jewish rabbi in the White House. It was this incredible moment. But I'm curious, as we talk about, you know, this question of who looks Jewish, what, like, to me, I look at a person like Angela Buchdahl, and also, by the way, you started the book with Mark Zuckerberg and his partnership with an Asian woman, Priscilla Chan, if I have her name right. Okay. And I'm curious, as we think about how we can shift Jewish communities to realizing that looking Jewish is not one uniform Ashkenazi kind of thing, whether those kinds of public faces really make a big difference, and if you looked at that at all as you were doing this research.
It's very powerful as a parent for our 5 and 8-year-old kids to see a YouTube clip of that moment in the White House and to say, oh, Rabbi Buchdahl, you know, there she is. It's Hanukkah. You know, that's such a great Jewish scene. And, you know, I think the presence of her in all of her, you know, backgrounds and traditions coming together in that moment gets their attention. And, you know, they identify with that and they see a lot of ways that she is a human being out in the world and can also themselves understand that they have lots of parts of them that they can bring to the world and talk about and share about and be curious about and ask their parents millions of questions about every day. And so I do think that having those public opportunities for the reminder to all of us that the Jewish community is a diverse, multiracial, one that has existed all over the planet for thousands of years is so significant.
If I could just add really briefly, Noah was talking about the importance of having somebody like Rabbi Buchdahl Warnick out there as a public figure, somebody who has a racially Asian face, kind of challenging our racialized understandings of who Jews are, particularly in this country. So there's I think what Noah was talking about was sort of seeing the Jewish people as a racially diverse people and that all the possibilities that lie ahead of us in terms of that. I think the complement to that is also being able to see her as somebody who is of a particular race and of a particular Asian ethnic background as Jewish. It's also seeing the diversity and possibility of religious variation within a racial group that encompasses, you know, over 50 different ethnicities, and not necessarily looking at her as a racially Asian person and thinking that she must be, you know, a Buddhist or possibly a Christian, but that she can be a Jew. Also, the story about Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan is really interesting because so much of the reaction with regards to the blogosphere revolved around the fact that Mark was raised as a Jew and Priscilla is not Jewish. We actually don't know that. I mean, how many of us actually know whether Priscilla Chan is Jewish or not? But I think the immediate assumption, because of what it is that she looks like and what her name is that she couldn't possibly be Jewish. But we actually don't know that.
So I'd love to go back to one of the comments that you opened with, if I understood it correctly, which was that when you look at the children of Asian Jewish marriages, that you find, I think you said a muscular Judaism, or maybe this was among the couples themselves, a muscular Judaism. If I understood you correctly, you were saying that the Judaism that's exhibited is not a Judaism that's fused in various ways with either Asian communities, practices, you know, cultural practices or other religious practices. Could you talk a little bit more about what you found there? Because I guess I'm asking, do you have any sense of why that is? I mean, I'm sure that many in the Jewish community might hear that and say, well, that's a good thing. It means that Judaism is somehow so strong that it isn't damaged by that kind of relationship, which is great on the one hand that it's not sort of, I don't know what you want to say, watered down or change. But I mean, part of me feels like I wish that I would be seeing more creativity. I mean, I think it would be really interesting to imagine what might be created. I mean, we certainly know a lot about different Jewish traditions that come from cultures in which the Jewish people lived in different countries and whatnot, and Jewish traditions are different from different lands. And I look at that as a wonderful thing about the diversity of Jewish practice. And, you know, part of me feels a little sad that we're not seeing a lot of innovation in Jewish expression among families where the other partner brings a rich tradition to the family as well.
If I'm understanding what you're asking, the idea of the cultural hybridization and its impact on the religious practice in the household definitely took place. But I would say that it took place in largely symbolic ways. So couples as well as adult kids talked about, you know, having certain kinds of Korean or Chinese foods included in the Passover Seder as a way of honoring all aspects of their heritage. If we think about, say, a bar and bat mitzvah and all of the symbolic elements that go into that ceremony, you could imagine wearing a Korean hanbok during the ceremony as a way of honoring kind of the Korean heritage as well as the Jewish side. So I would say at the level of that type of mixing, it largely took place in terms of these symbols. And I think there are opportunities for that kind of fusion if that is what is deemed important to you know, these individuals and the larger Jewish community. There's lots of opportunities for these kinds of, interesting ways of expressing Jewishness to take place.
I mean, if we look at recent Jewish history, right, and there's a wide communal memory, it seems, of people sort of growing up in the 60s and often discarding their Jewish identities partially or entirely, depends on who we're talking about, and immersing themselves in whether it's Buddhism or Taoism or various combinations of Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism. And so it's funny because I think there seems to be this sort of communal, I don't know if it's trauma or regret over that. So the result is we're a little bit afraid. But, you know, in a world where yoga has become one of the most common American hobbies, or maybe it's more than a hobby for some people, part of me thinks that we might, as Dan said, benefit a lot from figuring out ways that Judaism could fuse with Eastern ideas, while being wary of things like cultural appropriation and doing so in a way that's respectful of boundaries that do exist. So, I know, I mean, that's more of a thought than a question, but I'm curious if you think, there's any relationship between sort of the history of Jewish involvement in, it's funny because so many Jews are actually that identify as Jews are current leaders of American Buddhism. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if you think there's anything there for us to chew on in terms of that history and why we might be so nervous about fusions and things like that.
There's a lot swirling in my head. I think we were at a B'chol Lashon conference once, and one of the rabbis who talked had just published an article in Contemporary Jewry where he was addressing this very question about how it is that he as a rabbi and by extension Judaism could potentially benefit from the teachings of other religious and spiritual traditions. And if my memory is correct, there was something that he was really drawn to about Buddhism and its emphasis about being in the present that really allowed him to take with greater seriousness and downplaying the tendency to just kind of sort of do Judaism in a rote way. There's something that he was really drawn to about the tenets of being present within this particular strand of Buddhism that he was studying at the time that allowed him to come to Judaism and to, you know, grow as a rabbi and a Jewish thinker in a way that he really saw as complementary and that allowed him to be a better Jewish sort of thinker and teacher and scholar.
Well, I guess I was going to say I had a slightly different what went through my mind when you raised this was it is true that there was not very much discussion of, especially with young people, critiques of Judaism itself or Jewish practice. It was usually the critiques of the people in the Jewish community who just either didn't get it or had sort of an underlying racial ignorance or some inability to fully absorb that the young person they were talking to was a, you know, bona fide member of the tribe. But what one of the areas that I think about when I kind of hear the word, you know, innovation or creativity from you is that a number of the young people spoke with us about because of their racialized presentation to the world in a you know, mixed race, non-white Ashkenazi way, And the resulting kind of reflection and kind of inner searching and conversations that they had about their racial self, a lot of them talked about ways that they were involved with racial justice and social justice efforts more broadly with other racial or ethnic groups or multiracial groups who were not Jewish. And a number of them really talked about how their racial selves as Jews help them support, participate in, guide a lot of the social activism and social change efforts that were in their community or city or wherever they lived. And that struck me as in some ways innovative because it was a way to draw on the Jewish values of tikkun olam and social change, seeking liberation and justice from a racialized position as Jews that allowed the partnership and collaboration with other communities and people that might otherwise not be able to be part of that shared experience or part of that struggle. And so that was definitely dynamic. And I would say that was innovation that came about from an understanding about the Jewish call to justice, but also an opportunity that was in some ways available to them because of their kind of their multiraciality.
You know, I would expect somebody who is feeling excluded from the Jewish community based on their racial presentation to, let's say, have a stronger critique of the community that they're feeling not fully included in, as opposed to simply saying that they're ignorant and not realizing, you know, and not realizing certain things, you know, that I really am Jewish, et cetera. But, you know, I would expect sort of, or I would actually want more of a critique that says the reason why I'm being treated this way is because of X, Y, and Z problems that exist in the community. And, you know, I want to specifically address those problems or, you know, and a lot of people will not be of the type that will address those problems. A lot of those people tend to vote by exit, you know, and just don't involve themselves in the community that are excluding them. I mean, again, this is all how I kind of expect that people operate. And, you know, then specifically with people who have a strong cultural background from the other parent, it would be exciting to me if that critique could be brought into the Jewish community. So, you know, and I wonder if maybe this is, and if you know, is this, are some of these things particularly predominant in Asian Jewish relationships or children of Asian Jewish couples, or, you know, with, let's say, a child of an African American who wasn't Jewish and a Jewish parent, you know, then I might hope that that child's able to say, you know, the way in which you're treating me, fellow Jews, is very problematic, and specifically in light of the fact that I'm also African American and we have this whole story here in America, or in light of the fact that the Jewish community was more supportive of racial justice some X number of years ago, you know, and could be sort of playing the prophetic voice. Maybe that's kind of what I'm getting at, and be kind of strong change agents that are addressing some of the root causes of the reasons that they're not feeling fully embraced. And but that doesn't seem to be what I'm hearing you describe.
There were a couple of instances with some of the couples that we interviewed. Couples who had older kids, and they remarked on their kids having had negative experiences and being challenged for who it is that they were because they didn't look Jewish. And those parents did take those concerns to the leadership. But having said that, the kind of complaints leveled against individuals responsible for making larger scale decisions and enacting change at the communal level were few and far between, particularly for the adult kids of intermarriages.
In the spirit of asking these questions and conceivably critiquing the Jewish community, I wanted to hone in on one really interesting part of the book that I wasn't totally sure what to take from this, and maybe you can expand and help me. But you talk about how the lens that the Jewish community typically uses, especially around issues of intermarriage, certainly interreligious marriage and maybe interracial marriage too, is one of sociology, and maybe I would use this phrase, you didn't, but it's one of numbers and quantities and sort of continuity. And you brought this up in context of explaining your own methods and the fact that you didn't go the route of sociology. You didn't take a massive survey of all or many Jewish Asian couples and sort of come to conclusions. You had these interviews and that there might be some unique benefits to that. And I was curious if you could help explain what you meant by this idea that the lens of the Jewish community is sociological. And also part of that is that the lens has skewed from seeing intermarriage as a positive step towards sort of assimilation into society versus now a very negative step that threatens the future of the people. I'm curious just if that trend is embodying sort of a bigger Jewish communal structural issue that we might or might not critique or not.
Yeah, so through the sociological lens, so demographers tend to be sociologists or have some sort of sociological training. And the discipline, while it includes demography and collection of large-scale numbers, also does look at qualitative studies, kind of similar to the method that we pursued. Having said that, it is still a field, a discipline that is largely quantitatively based, in part because there's a belief and assumption that the kinds of questions and how it is that you answer supposedly unbiased questions tend to be more rigorous, can be more generalizable with large-scale numbers. And so Jewish sociologists, Jewish demographers who've been trained in this fashion, you know, continue to rely on numbers to either make the case or not make the case with regards to the impact of intermarriage. So that's just historically what the field has looked like and what the vast majority of the studies that look at intermarriage have focused on are the large-scale quantitative data sets. You know, when you ask questions where you either answer yes, no, or according to a 5-point Likert scale. And I love numbers. Numbers are great. Numbers are very powerful. So I would never say that numbers are not important. It's harder to get at the deeper meanings and meaning making that I would say are part of the strand of thought with regards to the transformation of Judaism in the Jewish community that really, I think, can be better captured with qualitative data gathering.
I was just going to mention, hearkening back to Gary Tobin, the demographer that Helen started the hour talking about, and reflecting on his inspiration and his encouragement of us to pursue our early questions about households that combine these two kinds of backgrounds. You know, to, I think, a certain extent, Gary did a great job as a demographer showing where these kinds of large quantitative demographic studies broke down and were unable to really characterize the fullness of Judaism in the United States. And that was some of the really pioneering work that he and his team and Diane, also Diane Tobin, were able to open up, was this way of getting richer data about a way of understanding the American Jewish community that was not coming through any of the studies that existed at the time. And so speaking personally, this wasn't an official part of our project, but personally, you know, Gary really was for me, the disruptor when it came to using these kinds of just large scale, you know, quantitative dumps to say, this is what Judaism is in America right now. This is what it's about. This is what's happening. And that was very liberating to hear the way he, as an expert, reached the limits and was very dissatisfied with it.
Great. So I guess in closing, is there anything that we haven't talked about that you think is especially significant that we should be talking about?
I guess I want to say, reflecting a little bit on the three really terrific shows that you both did on intermarriage a little while back. We're huge fans of both Karen and Paul and all of their work. And I really love the way you drew on their insights in the third show about especially the concerns around leadership and what leadership means in the American Jewish community today. I mean, I think to in some ways underscore a lot of what you talked about, but through what came about in our own learning through this research project was that, you know, more and more in our congregations and our communities, race is going to be in some ways the greatest influencer of what our congregations are about and what our congregational members bring to organized Jewish spaces. And where congregational leadership or Jewish communal leadership is able to embrace and support and open that up in a real way that for everyone feels authentic, that's going to be incredibly powerful. And I think that's where a lot of innovation will come from, will be those congregations and those organizational forms, not necessarily through the individual mixed race Jews that come to those, but through the whole institutional organization. And so that, I think, is going to be a really dynamic area to watch in the Jewish community over the next 5 or 6 years, is how leaders and leadership is able to have multiraciality be a kind of normal part of what their congregation is.
Yeah. And I'd say, kind of piggybacking off what Noah said, I think, you know, as I'm thinking about, in particular, the adult millennial children who we talked about, you know, they have multiple identities. And at the same time, they want to be Jewish. They want to continue being Jewish. But being Jewish may not necessarily be the one identity that is out there first and foremost, because they have so many other identities that encompass who it is that they are. So I think the trick is how to be responsive to a demographic that really sees itself in this way. Jewish communal organizations, the larger Jewish community, has to be responsive to the fact that it needs to think about ways to include all aspects of who it is that these individuals are. So I think the racial component is, while it's very prominent in terms of our research, it's one example of an identity alongside being Jewish.
Absolutely. I think that's a really important note to close on. And as a millennial myself, who does think about the very, very many identities I have, even as somebody who comes just from two Ashkenazi Jewish parents, I totally agree that for those who have a different kind of background and multiple kinds of racial backgrounds, religious backgrounds, that can totally play into how we see the world in a wide variety of ways. And we should absolutely internalize that. We want to close, well, first by thanking both of you, Professors Kim and Levitt, for coming onto the show. This has been fantastic.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
We really appreciate being able to share a little bit about it and to go into that kind of depth that this podcast allows.
Well, we really appreciate that you were able to make it onto the show. For those who want to go ahead and purchase Jewasian, we highly recommend it. It's a great read, really informative about some of the issues that we touched on this episode and many others as well. You can find it on Amazon, and they also have their own Facebook page, Jewasian, featuring a number of articles that have mentioned them recently, interviews, etc., which we're excited to see happening because we want more and more folks to be exposed to this kind of work. So, in conclusion, we'd also like to encourage you to follow us at Judaism Unbound. And there's a few ways for you to do that. One is through our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Another is through our website, judaismunbound.com. And also you can email us at dan@nextjewishfuture.org and lex@nextjewishfuture.org. And if you want to support what we're doing with a small monthly donation, you can always do so at our Patreon site, which is www.patreon.com. That's patreon.com/Judaism Unbound. So thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.